I've got two cartridges in this gun, Carson. Have you ever seen what cartridges like these can do? You don't even need to aim very well. Just pull the trigger and bang, you'd be blasted up against that wall. Fascinating, isn't it? I've come here to tell you I don't want you as my enemy. Enemy? Mads Gilstrup laughed. You people will always be my enemies. Do you remember the summer you bought Östgor, and I was invited by the commander himself, Ekoff? You felt sorry for me. I was the poor boy you'd deprived of childhood memories. You're sensitive about things like that. My God, how I hated you all. Gilstrup laughed. I stood watching you, playing and enjoying yourselves, as though the place belonged to you. Especially your brother, Robert. He had a way with the girls. Tickled them, and took them into the barn and... Gilstrup shifted his foot and hit the bottle, which toppled over with a clunk. Brown alcohol gurgled out onto the parquet floor. You didn't see me. None of you saw me. It was as though I didn't exist. You were absorbed in one another. So I thought, well, okay, then I must be invisible. I'll show you what invisible people can do. Is that why you did it? Me? Mads laughed. But I'm innocent, John Carson, aren't I? We, the privileged, always are. Surely you must know that. We always have a clear conscience because we can afford to buy it from others, from those who are employed to serve us, to do the dirty work. That's the law of nature. John nodded. Why did you call the policeman and confess? Gilstrup shrugged. I thought of calling the other one, Harry Hole, in fact, but the asshole didn't have a business card, so I called the one whose number I did have. Halverson, something or other. I don't remember because I was drunk. Have you told anyone else? John asked. Gilstrup shook his head, picked up the bottle off the floor and took a swig. My father. Father? John said. Ah, yes. Of course. Of course. Mads chortled. Do you love your father, John Carson? Yes. Very much. And do you not agree that love for a father is a curse? John did not answer, and Mads went on. Father was here right after I found the policeman, and when I told him, do you know what he did? He fetched his ski pole and hit me. And he can still hit hard, the bastard. Hatred gives you strength, you know. He said that if I mentioned a word of this to anyone, if I dragged the family's name into the dirt, he would kill me. Those were his exact words. And you know what? Mads's eyes filled with tears, and a sob caught his voice. I still love him. And I think that's what makes him hate me with such passion. The fact that I, his only son, am so weak that I can't even return his hatred. The room echoed as he banged the bottle down hard on the floor. John folded his hands. Listen to me. The policeman who heard your confession is in a coma. If you promise me you will never come after me or mine, I promise I will never reveal what I know about you. Mads Gilstrup did not appear to be listening to John. Instead, his gaze had turned to the screen, where the happy couple were standing with their backs to them. Look, now she's saying yes. I play that exact part again and again because I can't understand it. She swore, didn't she? He shook his head. I thought it might make her love me again. If I managed to carry out this crime, then she would see me as I am. A criminal must be brave, strong. A man, isn't that right? Not, he snorted through his nose and spat out the words, the son of one. John rose to his feet. I have to go. Gilstrup nodded. I have something that belongs to you. Let's call it, he bit his top lip as he reflected, a farewell present from Ranhill. On the Holmenkollen train, John sat staring at the black bag he had been given by Mads Gilstrup. It was so raw that those who had ventured out for a ramble were walking with hunched shoulders and bowed heads, swathed in hats and scarves. Standing on Jakob Olsgata and pressing the Moholjet family doorbell, however, Beata Lern did not feel the cold. She had not felt a thing since the latest message they had received from the hospital. "It's not his heart that's the biggest problem now," the doctor had said. "The other organs have problems too, above all his kidneys." Fru Miholjets was waiting in the doorway, above the stairs, and showed Beate into the kitchen, where Sophia sat, fidgeting with her hair. Then she filled the kettle and put out three cups.
"It might be best if I talk to Sophia on my own," Beate said.
"She wants me to be present," Fru Miholjets said.
"Coffee?"
"No, thanks. I have to get back to Rijkshospitalet. This doesn't have to take long."
"Fine," Fru Miholjets said, emptying the kettle. Beate sat opposite Sophia, tried to catch her eyes, which were studying split ends.
"Are you sure we shouldn't do this on our own, Sophia?"
"Why should we?" she said in the contrary tone that irritated teenagers use with amazing efficacy to achieve their purpose. To irritate.
"This is a very personal thing, Sophia.
She's my mother."
"Fine," said Beate.
"Did you have an abortion?" Sophia recoiled. She grimaced, a mixture of anger and pain.
"What are you talking about?" she snapped,
without quite hiding the surprise in her voice.
"Who was the father?" Beate asked.
Sophia continued to smooth out non-existent knots. Fru Miholjets's jaw had dropped.
"Did you have sex with him of your own free will?" Beate went on. "Or did he rape you?"
"How dare you say that to my daughter?" the mother exclaimed. "She's just a child, and you dare to talk to her as if she were a whore."
"Your daughter was pregnant, Fru Miholjets. I need to know if this has any relevance for the murder case we're working on."
The mother seemed to have control of her jaw again, and her mouth closed. Beate leaned towards Sophia.
"Was it Robert Carlson, Sophia? Was it?"
She could see the girl's lower lip quivering. The mother got up from her chair.
"What is this she's saying, Sophia? Tell me it isn't true."
Sophia rested her face on the table and covered her head with her arms.
"Sophia!"
the mother shouted.
"Yes,"
Sophia whispered, stifling a sob.
"It was him. It was Robert Carlson. I didn't think. I had no idea that he was like that."
Beata stood up. Sophia was sobbing, and the mother looked as though someone had struck her. All Beata felt was numbness.
"The man who killed Robert was caught last night," she said. "Special forces shot him at the container terminal. He's dead."
She watched for reactions but saw none.
"I'll be going now."
No one heard her, and she walked to the door unaccompanied. He was standing by the window, staring across the billowing white countryside. It resembled a sea of milk frozen in mid-movement. On the crests of some waves he glimpsed houses and red barns. The sun hung low over the ridge, drained.
"They're not coming back," he said. "They're gone.
Or maybe they were never here? Maybe you were lying?"
"They've been here,"
Martina said, taking the casserole out of the oven.
"It was warm when we arrived, and you saw the prints in the snow yourself. Something must have happened. Sit down. The food's ready."
He put the gun beside the plate and ate the stew. He noticed the containers were the same brand as the ones in Harry Hole's flat. There was an old blue transistor radio on the windowsill, playing comprehensible pop music interrupted by incomprehensible Norwegian chat. Right now it was a tune he had once heard in a film, one his mother had played now and then on the piano in front of the window, which was the only one in the house with a view of the Danube, as his father used to joke when he wanted to tease her. And if the teasing nettled her, he always used to bring the squabble to an end by asking how such a beautiful, intelligent woman could marry a man like him.
"Is Harry your lover?" he asked.
Martina shook her head.
"Why were you taking him a concert ticket then?"
She didn't answer. He smiled.
"I think you are in love with him."
She raised her fork and pointed it at him, as though wanting to emphasize something, but then changed her mind.
"What about you? Do you have a girl back home?"
He shook his head while drinking water from a glass.
"Why not? Too busy working?"
He sprayed water all over the tablecloth. Must be the tension, he thought. That was why he burst into hysterical laughter. She laughed with him.
"Or perhaps you're gay," she said,
wiping away a tear. "Maybe you've got a boy back home." He laughed even louder, and continued to laugh long after she had stopped speaking.
She served both of them more stew. "Since you like him so much, you can have this," he said, throwing a photo onto the table. It was the one on the hall mirror with Harry, the dark-haired woman, and the boy. She picked it up and studied it. "He looks happy," she said. "Maybe he was having a good time at that moment." "Yes." A grayish darkness had seeped in through the window and settled over the room. "Maybe he'll have good times again," she said softly. "Do you think that's possible? To have good times again?" "Of course." He studied the radio behind her. "Why are you helping me?" "I told you, didn't I? Harry wouldn't have helped you, and I don't believe you. There must be something else." She shrugged. "Can you tell me what this says?" he said, unfolding the form he had found in the pile of papers on Harry's coffee table and passing it to her. She read while he examined Harry's photograph on the ID card from his flat. The policeman was staring above the camera lens, and he guessed Harry was looking at the photographer instead of the camera. And he thought that said something about the man in the picture. "It's a requisition form for something called a Smith & Wesson 38, Martina said. "He's been asked to show this signed form and collect the gun from police HQ. He nodded slowly. "And it has been signed?" "Yes, by, let me see, Chief Inspector Gunnar Hagen. In other words, Harry hasn't collected his gun, and that means he is not dangerous. Right now he is defenseless." Martina blinked twice in quick succession. "What is it you have in mind?" 26. Saturday, December 20th. The magic trick. The streetlights went on Göteborgata.
"Okay," Harry said to Beata. "So, this is where Halvorsen was parked?"
"Yes."
"They got out and were attacked by Stankage, who first shot at John fleeing into the flats, and then went for Halvorsen, who was moving to get his gun from the car."
"Yes. Halvorsen was found lying beside the car. We found blood on Halvorsen's coat pockets, trouser pockets, and waistband. It isn't his, so we assume it's from Stankage, who must have been searching him, and he took his wallet and cell phone."
"Hmm," Harry said, rubbing his chin. "Why didn't he just shoot Halvorsen? Why use a knife? He didn't need to be quiet. He'd already woken up the neighborhood when he shot at John. We were asking ourselves the same question. And why stab Halvorsen and then flee? The only reason for tackling Halvorsen must be to get him out of the way, so that he can grab John afterward. But he doesn't even try. A car came, didn't it?"
"Yes, but we're talking here about a guy who has stabbed a policeman in broad daylight. Why would he be frightened off by a car coming past? And why use a knife when he already had his gun out?"
"Yes, that's the point." Harry closed his eyes for a long time. Beata stamped her feet on the snow.
"Harry," she said, "I want to go.
Harry slowly opened his eyes.
He'd run out of bullets.
"What?"
"That was Stankage's last bullet."
Beata heaved a weary sigh.
"He was a pro, Harry. You don't exactly run out of ammunition, do you?"
"Yes, that's exactly why," Harry said enthusiastically. "If you have a detailed plan of how you intend to kill a man, and you need one or maximum two bullets, you don't take a huge ammo supply with you. You have to enter a foreign country, all baggage is x-rayed, and you have to hide it somewhere, don't you?"
Beata didn't answer. Harry went on. "Stankage fires his last bullet at John and misses, so he attacks Halvorsen with a sharp instrument. Why? Well, to get his service revolver off him and chase John. That's why there's blood on Halvorsen's waistband. You don't look for a wallet there. You look for a gun, but he doesn't find one, because he doesn't know it's in the car. And now John has locked himself in the house, and Stankage has only a knife. So he gives up and makes a run for it."
"Great theory," Beata said with a yawn. "We could have asked Stankage, but he's dead, so it doesn't matter."
Harry observed Beata. Her eyes were small and red from lack of sleep. She had been tactful enough not to mention that he stank of recent and not-so-recent booze, or wise enough to know there was no point in confronting him. But he also understood that at this moment she had no confidence in him.
"What did the witness in the car say?" Harry asked.
"That Stankish made off down the left-hand side of the road?"
"Yes. She watched him in the mirror.
Then he fell on the corner, where we found a Croatian coin." He focused on the corner.
That was where the beggar with the beard had been standing the last time he had been here. Maybe he had seen something? But now it was -8 and no one was around. "Let's go to forensics," Harry said. Without a word, they drove up Toftesgata to Ring 2, past Ullevål Hospital. They were passing white gardens and English-style brick houses on Sonsvayen when Harry broke the silence. "Pull in." "Now? Here?"
"Yes."
She checked her mirror and did as he said. "Put the hazard lights on," Harry said, "and then concentrate on me. Do you remember the association game I taught you? You mean the one about speaking before you think? Or saying what you think before thinking that you shouldn't think that? Empty your mind." Beata closed her eyes. Outside, a family passed them on skis. "Ready?" "Okay." "Who sent Robert Carson to Zagreb?"
"Sophia's mother."
"Hmm," Harry said. "Where did that come from?"
"No idea,"
Beata said, opening her eyes. "She has no motive, as far as we're aware, and she is definitely not the type. Maybe because she is a Croatian like Stankic? My subconscious doesn't have such complicated thoughts." "All of that may be correct," Harry said, "apart from the last part about your subconscious. Okay, ask me."
"Do I have to ask aloud?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Just do it," he said, closing his eyes. "I'm ready."
"Who sent Robert Carson to Zagreb?"
"Nielsen."
"Nielsen? Who's Nielsen?"
Harry opened his eyes again. He blinked into the lights of the oncoming traffic, a little dazed. "I suppose it must be Rickard."
"Funny game," Beata said.
"Drive," Harry said. Darkness had fallen over Östgård. The radio on the windowsill jabbered away.
"Is there really no one who can recognize you?"
Martina asked.
"There are some who can," he said, "but it takes time to learn my face. Not many have taken the time.
So it's not about you.
It's the others.
Maybe.
But I don't want them to recognize me. That's something I do."
"You flee?"
"No, on the contrary. I infiltrate. I invade. I make myself invisible and sneak into places I want to be."
"But if no one sees you, what's the point?"
He looked at her in surprise. There was a jingle on the radio, and then a woman's voice began to speak with the neutral gravity of a newscaster.
"What is she saying?"
he asked.
"It's going to get even colder.
Nursery school's closing. Old people warned to stay inside and not to save electricity."
"But you saw me," he said. "You recognized me."
"I'm a people watcher," she said. "I see them. That's my one talent."
"Is that why you're helping me?" he asked. "Is that why you haven't tried to run away even once?"
She studied him.
"No, that's not why," she said at length.
"Why?"
"Because I want John Carson to die.
I want him to be even deader than you are."
He gave a start. Was she out of her mind?
"Me?
Did?
That's what they have been claiming on the news for the past few hours," she said, nodding toward the radio. She breathed in and put on the grave, imperious voice of the newscaster. "The man suspected of the Egger Dorge murder died last night, shot by police special forces during a raid on the container terminal. According to Sivert Falkeit, the special forces commander, the suspect refused to surrender and went for his gun. Oslo Crime Squad head chief inspector Gunnar Hagen has said the case will be put in the hands of SIFO, the Internal Affairs Division, as a matter of routine. Chief Inspector Hagen commented that this case is another example of the police having to deal with ever more brutal organized crime, and that discussion of whether to arm the police should not only be about effective law enforcement, but also the safety of our police officers." He blinked twice, three times. Then it dawned on him. Christopher, the blue jacket.
"I'm dead," he said. "That's why they left before we arrived. They think it's over."
He placed his hand on Martina's.
"You want John Carlson to die?"
She stared into space, breathed in as if she were going to speak, then released the air with a groan, as though the words she had found were not the correct ones, and tried again. At the third attempt, she succeeded.
"Because John Carlson knew. He's known for all these years. And that's why I hate him. And that's why I hate myself."
Harry eyed the naked corpse on the table. It almost didn't affect him anymore to see them like this. Almost. Room temperature was around 57 degrees, and the smooth cement walls returned a short, harsh echo as the female pathologist answered Harry's question.
No, we weren't thinking of doing an autopsy on him. The line's long enough as it is, and the cause is fairly obvious in this case, don't you think?
She motioned toward the face with the big black hole that had taken with it most of the nose and the top lip, leaving the mouth and the upper set of teeth open.
Bit of a crater, Harry said.
Doesn't look like the work of an MP5.
When will I have the report?
Ask your boss. He asked for it to go straight to him.
Hagen.
Yep. So, you'd better ask him for a copy if you're in a hurry.
Harry and Beata exchanged glances.
Listen, said the pathologist. The corners of her mouth stretched in what Harry realized was meant to be a smile. We're understaffed this weekend, and I have a lot on my plate, so if you wouldn't mind?
Of course,
Beata said. The pathologist and Beata made for the door, but both stopped when they heard Harry's voice.
Has anyone noticed this?
They turned to Harry, who was bent over the body.
He's got syringe marks.
Have you checked his blood for drugs? The pathologist sighed. He came in this morning, and all we have managed to do is put him in the freezer.
When can you have it done?
Is it vital? She asked, and seeing Harry's hesitation went on. An honest answer would be nice, because if we make it a priority, that will mean all the other cases you're nagging us for will be even more delayed. It's hell right now, coming into Christmas.
Well, Harry said, maybe he had the odd fix.
He shrugged.
But he's dead, and so I suppose it's not that vital. Did you take his watch?
Watch?
Yes. He was wearing a Seiko SQ50 when he was withdrawing money from the ATM the other day.
He didn't have a watch.
Hmm, Harry said, looking at his own bare wrist. Must have lost it.
I'll hop down to the intensive care unit,
Beata said when they were outside.
Okay, Harry said. I'll catch a taxi. Will you get the identity confirmed?
What do you mean?
So that we're 100% certain that Stankic's lying in there.
Of course. That's the usual procedure. The body has blood type A, which matches the blood we found on Halvorsen's pockets.
It's the most common blood type in Norway, Beata.
Yes, but they're checking the DNA profile as well. Are you not convinced?
Harry shrugged. It has to be done.
When? Tuesday at the earliest, all right?
3 days? Not all right.
Harry held up his hands in defense.
Fine, I'll go. Get some sleep, okay?
To be frank, you look like you need it more than I do.
Harry rested a hand on her shoulder, felt how thin she was under the jacket.
He's tough, Beata, and he wants to be here, okay?
Beata bit her lower lip, gave the impression she was going to say something, but flashed a quick smile and nodded. In the taxi, Harry took out his cell phone and called Halvorsen's cell, but as expected, there was no answer. Then he punched in the number of Hotel International. He got reception and asked to be put through to Fred in the bar.
Fred? Which bar?
The other bar, Harry said.
It's the policeman, Harry said when he had the barman on the line. The one who was in yesterday asking about Mali Spasite.
Da,
I have to talk to her.
She's had bad news, Fred said.
Goodbye.
Harry sat listening to the severed connection for a while. Then he put his cell in his inside pocket and gazed out the side window at the dead streets. Imagined her in the cathedral lighting another candle.
Schroeder's, the taxi driver announced, pulling in.
Harry sat at his usual table, staring into his half-full beer glass. The so-called restaurant was in fact a plain, shabby cafe serving alcohol, but it had an aura of pride and dignity that may have been due to the clientele, or perhaps the staff, or perhaps the impressive and out-of-place paintings adorning the smoke-stained walls. There weren't many people just before closing time, but in came a new customer who glanced around the room while unbuttoning the coat he wore over his tweed jacket, and then hastened toward Harry's table.
"Good evening, my friend," said Stola Orna. "This appears to be your regular corner."
"It's not a corner," Harry said without a hint of a slur. "It's an angle. Corners are on the outside. You walk around a corner, you don't sit in one."
"What about the expression, a corner table?"
"That's not a table in a corner, but a table with corners. As in, a corner sofa."
Orna gave a smile of pleasure. This was his type of conversation. The waitress arrived and gave him a brief, suspicious glance when he ordered tea.
"So,
Dunces are not sent to the corner, then, I assume, he said, straightening his red and white dotted bow tie. Harry smiled. Are you trying to tell me something, Mr. Psychologist? Well, I assume you called me because you wanted me to tell you something. How much do you charge to tell people that right now they should be ashamed of themselves? Be careful, Harry. Drinking makes you not only irritable, but irritating. I have not come here to divest you of your self-respect, your balls, or your beer. But your current problem is that all three are in that glass. You are eternally right, Harry said, raising his glass, and that's why I have to hurry up and finish this drink. Orna stood up. If you want to talk about your drinking, we can do this as usual in my office. This consultation is over, and you're paying for the tea. Wait, Harry said. Look. He turned around and put the rest of his beer on the empty table behind him. This is my magic trick. I control my boozing by ordering half a liter, which I take an hour to drink, a little sip every alternate minute, like a sleeping pill. Then I go home, and from the very next day I'm on the wagon. I wanted to talk to you about the attack on Halvorsen. Orna hesitated. Then he sat down again. Terrible thing. I heard the details. And what can you see? Glimpse, Harry. Glimpse, and hardly that. Orna nodded amiably to the waitress who brought his tea. But as you know, I glimpse better than the other good-for-nothings in my line of work. What I can see is that there are similarities between this attack and the murder of Ranhild Gilstrup. Tell me. Deep, heartfelt anger being vented. Violence caused by sexual frustration. As you know, bouts of fury are typical of borderline personalities. Yes, except that this individual seems to be able to control the fury. If not, we would have had more clues at the crime scenes. Good point. It may be a fury-driven assailant, or a person who commits violence, as the old maids in my profession would have us call them, who on a day-to-day basis may seem sedate, almost defensive. There was a recent article in the American Journal of Psychology about such people with what they call slumbering rage, what I call Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And when Mr. Hyde wakes up, Orna brandished the forefinger of his left hand while taking a sip of tea. It's Judgment Day and Armageddon at once, but once the fury has been released, he cannot control it. Sounds like a handy personality trait for a professional contract killer. Not at all. What are you referring to? Stankic loses points for style in the murder of Ranhild Gilstrup and the attack on Halvorsen. There's something unclinical about it, quite different from the murders of Robert Carlson and the others in the reports Europol sent us. An angry, unstable contract killer? Well, I suppose there are unstable airplane pilots and unstable managers of nuclear power stations, too. Not everyone is in a job he ought to be in, you know. I'll drink to that. In fact, I wasn't thinking about you just now. Do you know you have certain narcissistic qualities, Inspector? Harry smiled. Will you tell me why you're ashamed? Orna asked. Do you think it's your fault Halvorsen was stabbed? Harry cleared his throat. Well, it was me who gave him the task of looking after John Carlson. And it was me who should have taught him where you keep your gun when on babysitting duties. Orna nodded. So it's all your fault, as usual. Harry looked to the side and across the room. The lights had begun to flash, and the few customers left were obediently drinking up and putting on scarves and hats. Harry put a 100-kroner note on the table and kicked a bag out from under his chair. Next time, Stola. I haven't been home since Zagreb, and now I need some shut-eye. Harry followed Orna to the door, but was unable to stop himself from glancing back at the glass of beer on the table behind him. As Harry was unlocking the door to his flat, he noticed the smashed glass and swore aloud. It was the second time his flat had been broken into within a year. He noted that the intruder had taken the time to tape the glass so as not to arouse the curiosity of passing residents, yet had not taken the time to depart with the stereo or the TV. Easy enough to understand, since neither was this year's model, or the previous year's, and there were no other marketable items of value. Someone had moved the pile of papers on the coffee table. Harry went into the bathroom and saw the mess in the medicine cabinet above the sink, so it was not difficult to work out that a drug addict had been on the loose. He was puzzled by a plate on the countertop,
and the empty stew containers in the garbage bag under the sink? Had the unfortunate intruder been overwhelmed by a need for comfort food? Once in bed, Harry could feel the pain coming on and hoped he would be able to sleep while still somewhat under the effects of the alcohol. Through the crack between the curtains, the moon laid a white stripe along the floor to his bed. He tossed and turned as he waited for the ghosts. He could hear the rustling. It was only a question of time. Even though he was aware it was alcoholic paranoia, he thought he could smell death and bloodshed on the sheets. 27. Sunday, December 21st. The Disciple. Someone had hung a Christmas wreath outside the meeting room in the red zone. Behind the closed door, the last morning meeting of the investigative team was drawing to an end. Harry stood sweating in front of the assembled group in a tight-fitting dark suit. Since the contract killer, Stankage, and the go-between, Robert Carson, are both dead, the investigative team, in its present form, will be dissolved as of this meeting, Harry said, and that means most of us can look forward to a Christmas holiday this year. However, I will ask Hagen to make a few of you available for further detective work. Any questions before we wrap things up? Yes, Toriel. You say that the Stankic link in Zagreb confirmed their suspicion that Robert Carson contracted the murder of John. Who spoke to the link and how? I'm afraid I can't go into any details on that, Harry said, ignoring Beata's eloquent eyes and feeling the sweat running down his back. Not because of the suit or the question, but because he was sober. Okay, he continued. The next job is to find out who Robert was working with. In the course of today, I will contact the fortunate few who will be allowed to be involved. Hagen is holding a press conference later today and will take care of whatever has to be said. Harry shooed with his hands. Run along to your piles of paperwork, guys. Hey, shouted Skara over the scraping of chairs. Shouldn't we celebrate? The noise died away and the group looked at Harry. Well, Harry said quietly, I don't know quite what we should celebrate, Skara. That three people are dead, that the man behind Robert Carson is still free, or that we still have an officer in a coma. Harry watched them and did nothing to ease the painful silence that followed. When the room was empty, Skara went over to Harry, who was sorting through the notes he had written at 6 o'clock that morning. Sorry, Skara said. Rotten suggestion. That's all right, Harry said. You meant well. Skara coughed. Rare to see you in a suit. Robert Carlson's funeral is at 12, Harry said without looking up. Thought I would see who turned up. Right. Skara rocked back on his heels. Harry stopped flicking through his papers. Anything else, Skara? Well, yes. I was thinking that quite a few people in Crime Squad have got families and are looking forward to Christmas, whereas I'm single. Well, I'd like to volunteer. Volunteer? I mean, I'd like to keep working on the case, if you want me, that is, Skara hastened to add. Harry studied Magnus Skara. I know you don't like me, Skara said. It's not that, Harry said. I've already decided who will stay. And it's those I consider the best, not the ones I like. Skara shrugged, and his Adam's apple bobbed up and down. Fair enough. Merry Christmas, then. He moved toward the door. That's why, Harry said, putting the notes in the briefcase. I want you to start checking Robert Carlson's bank account. See what's gone in and out over the last 6 months and note any irregularities. Skara stopped and turned in amazement. Do the same for Albert and Mads Gilstrup. Have you got that, Skara? Magnus Skara nodded with enthusiasm. Check with Telenor if there have been any phone conversations between Robert and either Gilstrup during that period. Yes, and since it looks as though Stankic took Halverson's cell, check if there have been any conversations on that number. Talk to the prosecutor about access to bank accounts. No need, Skara said. According to new regulations, we have permanent access. Harry sent Skara a serious look. Thought it would be a good idea to have someone on the team who reads instructions. Yep. Then he strode out the door. Robert Carlson didn't have the rank of an officer, but since he had died on duty, it was decided that he would still be entitled to a grave in the area the army reserved for officers in Vestra Cemetery. After the burial, there was to be a memorial service with the corps in Meyerstuen. As Harry entered the chapel, John,
sitting alone on the front bench with Thea, turned his head. Harry noted the absence of Robert and John's parents. He and John made eye contact, and John gave a quick, somber nod, but there was gratitude in his expression. The chapel was, as expected, full to the last bench. Most people were wearing the Salvation Army uniform. Harry saw Rickard Nilsson and David Eckhoff, and beside them, Gunnar Hagen. There were also a few vultures from the press. At that moment, Roger Jentham slipped onto the bench next to him and asked whether he knew why the Prime Minister was not coming, as previously announced. "Ask the Prime Minister's office," Harry answered, knowing that the office had that very morning received a discreet telephone call from the top echelons of the police to talk about Robert Carlson's possible role in the murder case. The Prime Minister's office had subsequently remembered that the Premier had other, more pressing, engagements. Commander David Eckhoff had also received a call from Police HQ, and it had created panic in the Salvation Army headquarters, particularly since one of the key figures in the preparations for the burial, his daughter, Martina, had called in early that morning to say she was sick and would not be coming to work. The commander, however, had announced in a resolute voice that a man is innocent until the contrary has been proven beyond any shadow of doubt. Besides, he had added, it was too late to change the arrangement now. The show had to go on, and the Prime Minister had assured the commander his attendance at the Christmas concert was definite, whatever happened.
"Anything else?" Jentham whispered. "Anything new on the murders?"
"I understand you've all been told," Harry said. "The press have to go through Gunnar Hagen or the spokesperson. They're not saying anything. Sounds like they know their jobs."
"Come on, Hall. I know something's going on. The officer that was stabbed on Göteborgata. Is there any connection between him and the gunman you shot down last night?"
Harry shook his head in a way that could mean both no and no comment. The organ music stopped at that moment, the mumbling went silent, and the girl with the debut album stepped forward and sang a well-known psalm with an alluring amount of air and the suggestion of a groan, and brought it to an end by taking the final syllable on a roller coaster ride that Mariah Carey would have envied. For a second, Harry experienced an overwhelming yearning for a drink, but at long last she closed her mouth and bowed her head in sorrow to an imaginary storm of camera flashes. Her manager smiled with pleasure. It was obvious he hadn't received a telephone call from Police HQ. Eckhoff spoke to the congregation about courage and sacrifice. Harry was unable to concentrate. He looked at the coffin and thought about Halvorsen, and he thought about Stankic's mother. And when he closed his eyes, he thought about Martina. Afterward, six Salvation Army officers carried out the coffin. John and Rickard went first. John slipped on the ice as they turned on the gravel path. Harry left the others still gathered around the grave. He walked through the deserted part of the cemetery toward Fronja Park, where he heard the creak of shoes on the snow behind him. At first he thought it was a journalist, but when he heard the fast, agitated breathing, he reacted without thinking and spun around. It was Rickard, who came to a sudden halt.
"Where is she?" he wheezed.
"Where is who?"
"Martina. I heard she was ill today."
"Ill?"
"Yes." Rickard's chest was heaving. "But home in bed?" "No. And she wasn't at home last night either."
"How do you know?"
"Don't."
Rickard's shout sounded like a scream of pain, and his face went into contortions, as though he were no longer in charge of his own expressions. But then he caught his breath, and with what seemed like a huge exertion, pulled himself together.
"Don't try that on me," he whispered.
"I know. You've duped her, defiled her. She's in your flat, isn't she?
But you won't get..."
Rickard took a step toward Harry, who automatically took his hands out of his coat pockets.
"Listen," Harry said. "I have no idea where Martina is."
"You're lying!"
Rickard clenched his fists, and Harry realized he needed to find the correct words to calm him down in a hurry. He took a punt on these. "There are a couple of things you ought to reflect on right now, Rickard. I'm not very quick, but I weigh over 200 pounds, and I have punched my fist through an oak front door. And paragraph 127 of the Penal Code gives a minimum punishment of 6 months for violence against a public servant. You're risking a hospital visit and prison." Rickard's eyes smoldered.
"See you, Harry Hole," he said airily.
turned and ran back between the graves to the chapel. Imtiaz Rahim was in a bad mood. He had just had a fight with his brother about whether to put Christmas decorations on the wall behind the cash register. Imtiaz thought it was enough to sell pork, advent calendars, and other Christian paraphernalia without desecrating Allah by bowing to this kind of heathen custom. What would their Pakistani customers say? His brother, however, thought that they had to think of the other customers. For example, those from the apartment building on the other side of Göteborggata. It wouldn't hurt to give the grocer's shop a tiny touch of Christianity during the holiday period. Although Imtiaz had won the heated discussion, it gave him no pleasure. So it was with a heavy sigh that he heard the irascible ring of the bell over the door. A tall, broad-shouldered man in a dark suit entered and came over to the cash register. "Harry Hole, police," the man said, and for one small moment of panic, Imtiaz wondered whether there was a law in Norway stipulating that all shops had to display Christmas decorations. "A few days ago, there was a beggar sitting outside this shop," the policeman said, "a guy with red hair and a beard like this." He ran a finger over his top lip and down the side of the mouth. "Yes," Imtiaz said, "I knew him. He brings empty bottles here to get the deposit." "Do you know his name? The Tiger or the Cheetah?" "Pardon?" Imtiaz laughed. He was back in a good mood. "Tiger, after Tiger, your Norwegian word for beggar, and Cheetah because he pinches the empties from, we don't know where." Harry nodded. Imtiaz shrugged. "It's my nephew's joke." "Hmm, very good. So, no, I don't know his name, but I do know where you can find him." Espen Kaspersen was sitting with a pile of books in front of him, as usual, in the Dyke-Munske Public Library on Henrik Ibsen's gate, when he felt a figure loom above him. He looked up. "Hole, police," the man said, and sat down at the long table in the chair opposite. Espen saw the girl reading at the end of the table look over. New employees in reception did ask to check his bag when he left, and twice he had been asked to leave because he stank so much they couldn't concentrate on their work. This was the first time the police had talked to him, though. Well, except when he was begging in the street, that is. "What are you reading?" the detective asked. Kaspersen shrugged. He could see right away it would be a waste of time telling this policeman about his project. "Søren Kierkegaard," said the detective, peering at the spine. "Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, philosophy. You're a thinker." Espen Kaspersen sniffed. "I'm trying to find the right path, and that implies thinking about what it is to be human." "Isn't that being a thinker?" Kaspersen observed the man. Maybe he had misjudged him. "I was talking to the grocer on Göteborggata," the detective said. "He says you sit here every day, and when you're not sitting here, you're begging in the street." "This is the life I've chosen, yes." The detective took out a notepad, and when asked, Espen Kaspersen gave his full name and his address at his great-aunt's on Hagagata. "And profession?" "Monk." Kaspersen watched with satisfaction as the detective took notes without a murmur. The detective nodded. "Well, Espen, you're no drug addict, so why do you beg?"
"Because it's my mission to be a mirror for mankind, so that they can see which actions are great and which small."
"And which are great?" Espen sighed in despair, as though weary of repeating the obvious.
"Charity. Sharing and helping your neighbor. The Bible deals with nothing else. In fact, you have to search extremely hard to find anything about sex before marriage, abortion, homosexuality, or a woman's right to speak in public. But of course, it is easier for Pharisees to talk aloud about subordinate clauses than to describe and perform the great actions that the Bible leaves us in no doubt about. You have to give half of what you own to someone who has nothing. Thousands of people are dying every day without hearing the words of God because these Christians will not let go of their earthly goods. I'm giving them a chance to reflect." The detective nodded. Kaspersen was puzzled. "How did you know, by the way, that I am not a drug addict?"
"Because I saw you a few days ago on Göteborggata. You were begging and I was walking with a young man who gave you a coin. But you picked it up and threw it at him in a rage. A drug addict would never have done that, however insignificant the coin."
"I remember.
And then the same thing happened to me in a bar in Zagreb 2 days ago, and I began to think. That is, something made me think, but I didn't, until now.
There was one reason I threw the coin,
Kasperson said. That was what suddenly struck me, Harry said, placing an object in a plastic bag on the table. Is this the reason? 28. Sunday, December 21st. The Kiss. The press conference was held in the lecture hall on the fourth floor. Gunnar Hagen and the chief superintendent were sitting on the podium, their voices reverberating around the large, bare room. Harry had been summoned to attend in case Hagen needed to confer with him over details of the investigation. However, the journalists' questions were mostly about the dramatic shooting incident at the container terminal, and Hagen's answers varied between, "No comment, I can't go into that," and "We'll have to leave it to SIFO to answer that." To the question about whether the police knew if the gunman was in cahoots with anyone, Hagen answered, "Not for the moment, but this is the subject of intense investigation." When the press conference came to an end, and the hall was emptying, Hagen called Harry over. He looked down from the podium at his tall inspector. "I gave clear instructions that I wanted to see all my inspectors carrying weapons this week. You received a requisition order from me, so where's yours?" "I've been involved in the investigation and did not make it a priority, boss." "Make it a priority." The words echoed around the hall. Harry nodded slowly. "Anything else, boss?" In his office, Harry sat staring at Halverson's empty chair. Then he called the passport office on the second floor and asked them to get him a list of passports issued to the Carlson family. A nasal female voice asked if he was kidding, there being quite a number of Carlsons in Norway, and he gave her Robert's national identity number. Using the National Registration Office and a medium-fast computer, the search was soon narrowed down to Robert, John, Joseph, and Dorte. "The parents, Joseph and Dorte, have passports renewed 4 years ago. We haven't issued a passport to John. And let's see, the machine's a bit slow today. There, yes, Robert Carlson has a 10-year-old passport that will soon be invalid, so you can tell him to..." "He's dead." Harry dialed Skara's number and asked him to join him at once. "Nothing," said Skara, who, by chance or in a sudden fit of tact, sat on the edge of the desk instead of Halverson's chair. "I've checked the Jostrup's accounts, and there is no link anywhere with Robert Carlson or with Swiss bank accounts. The only unusual transaction was a cash withdrawal of 5 million kroner in dollars from one of the company accounts. I called Albert Jostrup and asked, and he said without any hesitation that they were the Christmas bonuses for the harbour masters in Buenos Aires, Manila and Bombay, whom Mads visits in December. Quite a business those people are in. And Robert's account? Incoming wages and minor withdrawals throughout. What about calls from the Jostraps? None to Robert Carlson. But we came across something else while going through the itemized telephone bills. Guess who called John Carlson heaps of times and on occasion in the middle of the night? Runhill Jostrup," Harry said, looking into Skara's disappointed face. "Anything else?" "No," Skara said, "apart from a familiar number making an appearance. Mads Jostrup called Halverson the day he was attacked. Unanswered call." "I see," Harry said. "I want you to check one more account." "Whose?" "David Eckhoff's." "The commander? What should I look for?" "Don't quite know. Just do it." After Skara had gone, Harry phoned forensics. The female pathologist promised, without any delay or fuss, to fax a photograph of Christo Stankic's body to a number at Hotel International in Zagreb. Harry thanked her, put down the telephone and dialed the number of the same hotel. "There's also the question of what to do with the body," he said when he had been put through to Fred. "The Croatian authorities don't know anything about a Christo Stankic, and therefore have not requested his extradition." 10 seconds later, he heard her schooled English. "I would like to suggest another deal," Harry said. Klaus Torkelsen, in the Telenor Operations Center for the Oslo region, had one aim in life: to be left in peace. And since he was very overweight, always perspiring and for the most part grumpy, by and large his wish was fulfilled. With regard to the contact he was forced to have with others,
He made sure there was maximum distance. That was why he sat alone a lot, enclosed in a room in the operations section with several hot machines and cooling fans, where few, if any, knew exactly what he was up to. All they knew was that he was indispensable. The need for distance may also have been the motivation for him to expose himself and thus, on the odd occasion, achieve satisfaction with a partner who was 5 to 50 yards away. However, Klaus Torkelson's utmost desire was to be left in peace, and he had had enough hassle for this week. First, it was that Halvorsen who wanted a line to a hotel in Zagreb monitored. Then Skara needed a list of the conversations between a Gilstrup and a Carlson. Both had referred to Harry Hall, whom Klaus Torkelson still owed a certain debt of gratitude. And that was the only reason he did not put down the telephone when Harry Hall himself called. "There's something called the police answering service," Torkelson said in a sulky tone. "If you go by the book, you should call them if you need help."
"I know," Harry said. He didn't need to say any more. "I've called Martina Eckhoff 4 times without getting an answer," Hall said. "No one in the Salvation Army knows where she is, not even her father."
"They're the last to know," said Klaus, who knew nothing about that kind of thing, but it was the sort of knowledge you could acquire if you were a regular moviegoer. Or, in Klaus Torkelson's case, an extremely regular moviegoer. "She may have switched off her cell, but I was wondering whether you could try to locate it for me, so that I know whether she's in town or not, at any rate." Torkelson sighed, a pose, pure and simple, because he adored these little police jobs, especially when they were of the shady variety.
"May I have her number?"
15 minutes later, Klaus called back to say that her SIM card was definitely not in Oslo. 2 base stations, both to the west of the E6, had received signals. He explained where the base stations were and what range they had. Since Hall thanked him and hung up at once, Klaus presumed he had been of some help and returned with relish to the list of the day's movie times. John let himself into Robert's flat. The walls still smelled of smoke, and there was a dirty T-shirt lying on the floor in front of the cupboard, as though Robert had been in and then popped out to the shop to buy coffee and cigarettes. John put the black bag Mats had given him next to the bed and turned up the radiator, threw off all his clothes, went into the shower and let the hot water beat down on his skin until it was red and nubbly. He dried himself, left the bathroom, sat down naked on the bed and stared at the bag. He hardly dared open it, for he knew what was inside, behind the thick, smooth material. Perdition. Death. John thought he could smell the stench of decay already. He closed his eyes. He needed to think. His cell rang. Thea must be wondering where he was. He didn't feel like talking to her now, but it kept ringing, insistent and inescapable, like Chinese water torture, and in the end he snatched the phone and said, in a voice he could hear was shaking with anger, "What is it?" But there was no answer. He read the display but didn't recognize the number. John realized it was not Thea calling. "Hello, this is John Carson," he said guardedly. Still nothing. "Hello, who is it? Hello, I can hear someone is there. Who?" Panic tiptoed up his spine. "Hello?" he heard himself say in English. "Who is this? Is that you? I need to speak to you. Hello?" There was a click, and the connection was cut. Ridiculous, thought John. Probably a wrong number. He swallowed. Stankic was dead. Robert was dead. And Ranhill was dead. They were all dead. Just the policeman was still alive, and him. He stared at the bag, felt the cold come creeping in and pulled the duvet over him. After turning off the E6 and driving some way down the narrow roads in the snow-covered rural landscape, Harry looked up and saw the stars were out. He had a strange, trembling feeling that something was going to happen soon, and when he saw a shooting star tear a parabola through the base of the sky ahead of him, he thought if omens existed, this had to mean something. He saw light in the windows on the ground floor of Östgård. Turning into the drive, he saw the electric car, and the feeling that something was looming was reinforced. He walked toward the house, observing the footprints in the snow, stood by the door with his ear to it. There was the sound of low voices. He knocked, 3 quick taps. The voices died away. Then he heard steps and her soft voice. "Who is it?"
It's Harry, he said. Hall. He added the latter so as not to awaken a third-party's suspicion that he and Martina Eckhoff had too personal a relationship. There was some fumbling with the lock. Then the door opened. His first and only thought was that she was pretty. She was wearing a soft, thick white cotton blouse, open at the neck, and her eyes were radiant.
I'm glad, she said with a laugh. I can see.
Harry smiled. And I'm glad too. Then her arms were around his neck, and he could feel her accelerated pulse.
How did you find me?
She whispered in his ear. Modern technology. The heat from her body, the gleam in her eyes, the whole ecstatic welcome gave Harry an unreal sense of happiness, a pleasant dream he, for his part, had no desire to wake from in the immediate future. But he had to. Is anyone here? He asked.
No.
I thought I heard voices.
Oh, that, she said, letting him go. That was just the radio.
I switched it off when I heard the knocking. I got a little frightened. And then it was you. She patted him on the arm.
It was Harry Hall.
No one knows where you are, Martina.
Wonderful.
Some of them are worried.
Oh?
Especially Rickard.
Oh, forget Rickard.
Martina took Harry's hand and led him into the kitchen. She took down a blue coffee cup from the cupboard. Harry noticed there were two plates and two cups in the sink.
You don't look that ill to me, he said.
I just needed a day off after all that's happened.
She poured the coffee and passed him the cup.
Black, wasn't it?
Harry shrugged. She had the heat on high, and he took off his jacket and sweater before sitting at the table.
But tomorrow it's the Christmas concert and I have to go back.
She sighed.
Are you coming?
Well, I was promised a ticket.
Say you're coming.
Then Martina bit her lower lip.
Oh dear. In fact, I had tickets for us in the VIP box. 3 rows behind the Prime Minister. But I had to give yours to someone else.
That doesn't matter.
You would have been left on your own anyway. I have to work backstage.
So it really doesn't matter.
No,
she laughed.
I want you to be there.
She took his hand. Harry looked at her small hand, which was squeezing and stroking his large paw. It was so quiet, he could hear his blood rushing like a waterfall in his ears.
I saw a shooting star on the way here. Harry said. Isn't that strange? A meteor is supposed to bring good luck.
Martina gave a silent nod. Then she stood up without letting go of Harry's hand, walked around the table and sat astride his lap, facing him, put her hand around his neck.
Martina, he began,
shh. She ran her index finger over his lips, and without taking her finger away, she leaned forward and placed her lips gently against his. Harry closed his eyes and waited, feeling his heart pound, heavily, pleasurably, though he was sitting quite still. It occurred to him he was waiting for her heart to beat in tune with his, but knew for certain only this. He would have to wait. Then he felt her lips part and automatically he opened his mouth and his tongue lay flat in his mouth, against his teeth, ready to receive hers. Her finger had an exciting, bitter taste of soap and coffee that burned the tip of his tongue. Her hand squeezed his neck tighter. Then he felt her tongue. It pressed against her finger so that he had contact on both sides, and it made him think it was split, like a snake's tongue, that they were giving each other two half kisses. She let go.
Keep your eyes closed,
she whispered by his ear. Harry leaned back and resisted the temptation to put his hands on her hips. The seconds passed. Then he felt the soft cotton material on the back of his hand as her blouse slipped to the floor.
Now you can open them, she whispered.
Harry did as instructed, and sat watching her. Her face expressed a mixture of anxiety and anticipation.
You're so beautiful,
he said in a voice that had become constricted and odd, also bewildered. He noticed her swallow. Then a triumphant smile spread across her face.
Raise your arms,
she commanded. She grabbed hold of his t-shirt at the bottom and pulled it over his head.
And you're ugly, she said. Wonderful and ugly.
Harry felt an intoxicating stab of pain as she bit into his nipple. One of her hands had moved behind her back and between his legs. Her breathing against his neck began to race, and her other hand grabbed his belt. He held his arm against her lithe back. That was when he felt it. An involuntary quiver of her muscles, a tension she had managed to hide. She was frightened.
Wait, Martina,
Harry whispered.
Her hand froze. Harry lowered his mouth to her ear.
Do you want this? Do you know what you're getting yourself into here?
He could feel her breathing, quickened and moist against his skin, as she gasped,
No. Do you?
No.
And perhaps we shouldn't.
She sat up, looking at him with wounded, desperate eyes.
But I can feel that you... Yes,
Harry said, caressing her hair.
I want you. I have wanted you from the first moment I saw you.
Is that the truth? She said, taking his hand and laying it against a hot, flushed cheek. Harry smiled.
The second, anyway.
The second time?
Okay, the third, then. All good music takes a little time.
And I'm good music?
I'm lying. It was the first time.
But that doesn't mean I'm a pushover, okay? Martina smiled. Then she started laughing. Harry, too. She leaned forward and rested her forehead against his chest, shook with laughter, and banged against his shoulder, and it was only then that Harry felt her tears running down his stomach and realized she was crying. John was woken by the cold. He thought. Robert's flat was dark, and there could be no other explanation. But then his brain rewound, and he knew that what he assumed were the final fragments of a dream were not. He had heard a key in the lock, and the door opening. Now someone was in the room, breathing. With a sense of déjà vu, that everything in this nightmare was repeating itself, he whirled around. A figure stood over the bed. John gasped for air as the fear of death attacked, its teeth sinking into his flesh and striking the nerves beneath, for he had total certainty, was quite sure that this person wished him dead. Stiglasan, the figure said. John didn't know many Croatian words, but the ones he had picked up from the tenants from Vukovar were enough for him to be able to work out what the voice had said.
I have come.
Have you always been lonely, Harry?
I think so.
Why?
Harry shrugged. I've never been the sociable type.
Is that all? Harry blew a ring of smoke up to the ceiling and could feel Martina sniffing at his sweater and his neck. They were in the bedroom, he on top of the duvet, she beneath.
Bjarne Müller, my former boss, says people like me always choose the line of most resistance. It's in what he calls our accursed nature. That's why we always end up on our own. I don't know. I like being alone. Perhaps I have grown to like my self-image of being a loner, too. What about you?
I want you to talk.
Why?
I don't know. I like listening to you. How can anyone like the self-image of a loner?
Harry took a deep breath, held the smoke in his lungs, thinking how good it would be if you could blow smoke patterns to explain everything. Then he released the smoke in one long exhalation. I think you have to find something about yourself that you like in order to survive. Some people say being alone is unsociable and selfish. But you're independent, and you don't drag others down with you, if that's the way you're headed. Many people are afraid of being alone. But it made me feel free, strong and invulnerable.
Strong from being alone?
Yep. As Dr. Stockman said, the strongest man in the world is he who stands most alone.
First Suskind's? And now Ibsen.
Harry grinned. That was a line my father used to quote. He sighed and then added, Before my mother died.
You said it made you invulnerable. Is that no longer the case?
Harry felt the ash fall from his cigarette onto his chest. He left it where it was. I met Raquel and, well, Oleg. They attached themselves to me. It opened my eyes to the fact that there could be other people in my life. People who were friends and who cared about me, and that I needed them.
Harry blew on his cigarette, making it glow, and, even worse, that they might need me.
So you weren't free any longer?
No.
No, I wasn't free any longer.
They lay staring into the dark. Martina nestled her nose into his neck.
You really like them, don't you?
Yes.
Harry pulled her close.
Yes, I do.
After she had fallen asleep, Harry slipped out of the bed and tucked the duvet in around her.
He checked the time. 2 o'clock on the dot. He walked into the hall, put on his boots, and opened the door to the starry night. Heading for the outhouse, he studied the footprints while trying to remember whether it had snowed since Saturday morning. The outhouse was not lit, so he struck a match and oriented himself. As it was about to go out,
he spotted two letters carved into the wall under a fading picture of Princess Grace of Monaco. In the dark, Harry mused that someone had been sitting here, as he was, diligently forming the simple declaration R plus M. Coming out of the outhouse, he caught a quick movement by the corner of the barn. He stopped. There was a set of footprints going that way. Harry hesitated. There it was again, the feeling that something was about to happen right now, something fated, which he could not prevent. He put a hand inside the outhouse door and found the spade he had seen standing there. Then he began to follow the prints to the barn. At the corner he paused and took a firm grip on the spade. His breathing thundered in his ears. He stopped breathing. Now. It was going to happen now. Harry plunged around the corner with the spade at the ready. Ahead of him, in the middle of the field, shining so bewitchingly and so white in the moonlight that he was dazzled, he saw a fox running toward the woods. He slumped back against the barn door and inhaled trembling lungfuls of air. There was a knock at the door, and he backed away out of instinct. Had he been seen? The person on the other side of the door must not come inside. He cursed his carelessness. Bobo would have scolded him for breaking cover in such an amateurish way. The door was locked, but he still cast around for an object he could use in case whoever it was managed to make his way in. A knife. Martina's bread knife that he had just been using. It was in the kitchen. There was another knock. And then there was his gun. Empty, it was true, but enough to scare off a sensible man. The problem was that he doubted if this one was. The person had arrived in a car and parked outside Martina's flat on Sorgenfregatta. He hadn't seen him until he chanced by the window and scanned the cars parked by the curb. That was when he had seen the motionless silhouette inside one of them. On seeing it move, leaning forward to see better, he knew it was too late. He had been seen. He had come away from the window, waited for half an hour, then lowered the blinds and switched off all the lights in Martina's flat. She had said he could leave them on. The radiators all had thermostats, and since 90% of the energy of a light bulb is heat, the electricity you save by turning them off would be counterbalanced by the radiators compensating for the heat loss. Simple physics, she had explained. If only she had explained to him what this was instead. A demented suitor? A jealous ex-lover? It wasn't the police, anyway, because he had started up again, a desperate, pained howl that made his blood run cold. Martina! Martina! Then a few tremulous words in Norwegian, and then almost a sob. Martina! He had no idea how the guy had got in through the front door, but now he could hear one of the other doors opening and a voice. Among the snatches of foreign words, there was one he recognized now. Polizzi! Then the neighbor's door was slammed shut. He heard the person outside groaning in despair and fingers scratching at the door. Then footsteps finally dying away. He heaved a sigh of relief. It had been a long day. Martina had driven him down to the station in the morning, and he had caught the local train to town. The first thing he had done was go to the travel agent at Oslo Central, where he had bought a ticket for the last flight to Copenhagen the following evening. They hadn't reacted to the Norwegian-sounding surname he had given them, Halvorsen. He had paid with the cash in Halvorsen's wallet, thanked them and left. From Copenhagen he would call Zagreb and have Fred fly there with a new passport. If he was lucky, he would be back for Christmas Eve. He had been to three hairdressers, who had all shaken their heads and said they had no appointments left before the holiday. The fourth had nodded to a gum-chewing teenage girl sitting in a corner and looking lost. He guessed she was an apprentice. After several attempts at explaining what he wanted, he had finally shown her the photograph. She had stopped chewing, looked up at him with eyes thick with mascara, and asked in MTV English, "You sure, man?" Afterward, he had taken a taxi to the address on Sorgenfregatta, unlocked the doors with the keys he had been given by Martina, and begun the wait. The telephone